So, this is probably one of the most sordid, disturbing and upsetting passages in the entire Bible. I don't remember if it was last week or 2 weeks ago. I think it was last week, as we were talking about Samson. We said that one of the problems in Scripture is a lot of times events are simply related. They're simply described without any commentary from the narrator on whether these are good events or bad events. And this story is, okay, I'm talking. This story is one of those where we really don't know what we're supposed to think. The audience is left to their own devices to try to make moral sense out of what's going on. So this story, kind of like the other story, is kind of a complicated event. There are a lot of pieces and a lot of parts in this. Kind of like the story with Micah and the Danites, you have a Levite, you have an entire tribe, and then you have a third party. So there are a lot of parallels between these two stories. Like the story of the young man Jonathan and Micah and the Danites, you also have people behaving in a way that seems to be shocking in Israel. People are doing things that are supposed to be shocking. They're things where Israel has no king and everybody does what is right in his own eyes. And we have both of these narratives are also a little bit on the longish side, and they emphasize really what it was like in Israel at that time and in those days. And so as we look at these chapters 19, 20, and 21, I'm hoping that everybody read them. I didn't say in the handout to read all three of these chapters. So I'm going to give. I think it sounds like some people did. So did anybody read? Has anybody read all three of these chapters? To kind of prepare for tonight at all. You read two. Which two did you read? 19 and 20. Okay, and then now chapter 21, the wives of the Benjamites. Probably a month ago, I kind of did a quick synopsis of that, so that should be fairly familiar. But okay, so you read 19 and 20, Gene. What really stood out to you in chapters 19 and 20? Yeah.
Eliza, go get some napkins, honey.
Yeah, it's certainly a barbaric story. It's something that stands out because of its gruesomeness. And what's important to see in the Judges is not only this event in and of itself, but how this event is used later in Samuel. Because if we remember, looking forwards, Saul is going to do the same thing. Because to give a brief overview of the history, so the age of the judges continues until Eli is the judge. Eli has two wicked children, Hophni and Phinehas. They're not to be trusted. And Samuel becomes the judge and the leader of Israel. But his kids are kind of chumps. And again, the Israelites sin, they turn away from the Lord, and God raises up an enemy of the people of Israel called Nahash the Ammonite. Nahash the Ammonite is threatening Israel, and he besieges a city. Well, the people were afraid of Nahash, and that's why they wanted a king, and the Bible tells us that later. It gives some explanation. Samuel says, but you were afraid of Nahash the Ammonite, and that's why you cried out for the king. They have a king. Nahash the Ammonite comes, and he besieges this Israelite city, and they said, okay, how about this? How about you give us a chance to send messengers to see if anybody will lift the siege? And if not, then we'll surrender to you. And Nahash the Ammonite is like, okay, well, that's a fair deal. And so they send out messengers, and one of the messengers comes to Saul, who is already the king. And Saul hears this word of this disgrace that's going to happen to Israel, and he takes an ox, and he slays the ox, and he splits the ox into all these little pieces, sends them to all the people of Israel, and he says, this will be done to anyone who doesn't rally before Saul and before Samuel to rescue this Israelite city. So what's happening is not only is the writer of the Judges telling us this gruesome act that was done to the concubine, but later this event is going to be used to further clarify Samuel, or to further clarify Saul. Who really is Saul? How do we understand the character of Saul? Well, we understand the character of Saul by understanding the character of the Levite and the fact that Saul's behavior parallels the behavior of the Levite. Other things that kind of stand out. Brian, you read a little bit of the text in preparation, right? So, yeah. Yeah, the numbers that we see are staggering. And again, we, you know, there are people who kind of look at this and they say, they question the numbers, they question the validity of the numbers. But we also have enough details in the text that talks about, you know, one in every 10 men was to be part of a foraging party who would support the army. I mean, those are the kind of details that are added that you normally don't add if you're speaking in figurative numbers. I mean, the numbers are very specific. I don't think they're made up. I think these are actual numbers of soldiers that rallied to the cause and came out to fight. So there's a lot of specificity, and yeah, so I think that's a good. Dean, you had done some reading, you said, in preparation. Did you read the whole? Okay. Do you remember anything that stands out to you as you think about the text? Yeah, so we, and who does that remind us of? Yeah, the whole thing, this whole story is to remind us of Lot. The parallels are almost unmistakable. You can't miss the parallel. That the city of Gibeah is supposed to be like Sodom. If you miss that, you're not paying attention. I mean, the author does everything but call them Sodom. And the fact that he doesn't call them that is even more powerful because the accusation stands on its own. You are behaving just like the Sodomites did. And so we see something similar happening. There's a lot of parallels that are important. But we see the moral compromises that are made there. Like, the guy is not simply saying, like, yes, I'm going to follow ancient Middle Eastern, Near Eastern practices of hospitality where I cannot allow. And to be fair, you cannot. The Near Eastern and Middle Eastern custom says if somebody is your house guest, you need to protect them with your life. Those are the laws of hospitality. But he's not willing to fight his townsmen. He's not willing to hold them back. He's just saying, like, hey, don't rape my guest, rape his concubine and or one of my virgin daughters. And you're supposed to go back to Lot, and you're supposed to question, well, what about Lot? What do we know about Lot? What do we think about Lot? Because when we see Lot, we also see somebody who tried to steal the best deal away from Abraham. So Lot doesn't come off super great in the earlier parts of Genesis. So we're stuck with more of these moral conundrums of what is right. And I think, and not to just start preaching right away, but I think that's one of the questions we're supposed to be asking ourselves as we look at this text, is we see these moral compromises, people doing things, and we're kind of stuck saying, like, I don't know what's right to do here. Like, you want to, on one hand, you want to condemn the guy for saying, here, take my virgin daughter, because that was wrong. But on the other hand, if he thought that was the only way to protect his house guest, did he think that they would actually, upon him asking that, that maybe they would go away and say, oh gosh, what we're doing is really bad. We probably shouldn't be doing this. Eliza, stop touching that. Get in here. Now. So, we're stuck with this question. What is right to do? Which is the whole point of the judges, is people didn't know what was right because everybody did what was right in their own eyes. People just did what was right in their own eyes. And so, yeah, so we come to that. Other things that stand out to us in the text. Why does that stick out to you? So that's a really good question. So I'll give the example because I've given this example before and people have always found it helpful. If you guys don't think it's helpful, that's fine too, I guess. But if I can get this to work, how do these chairs work? Okay, we'll pretend that they work. Okay, so the Israelites fought, a lot of them had small shields or they would have like a figure of eight buckler. But almost everybody is right-handed. So where do you carry your shield? Carry your shield in your left arm. So if you're carrying a shield, pretend it's a buckler. You're carrying your shield here, right? And when you come into battle, although they weren't like a Greek phalanx of the Roman legion, they would still fight in fairly close combat, especially as they're marching. And the reason why is because your shield is on your left hand, and most people didn't have good swords, they would have spears, and so you have to leave a little bit of room, but you want to stand as close to your friends as possible. The problem is just the way that your arm stands, everybody's shields are this way. A right-handed slinger, the arc of their throw is going to come this way. A left-handed slinger, the arc of their throw is going to come this way. So a left-handed slinger is going to have, just because of the angle of their throw, I mean, sure, they have to hit the right target, but you're going to have a much better chance with a left-handed slinger of hitting somebody because the shield is going to be open this way, not open this way. And that was why, if you look at ancient cities, some of the ancient fortresses, everybody has to make a left turn to get into the city. A lot of them have deliberate curves built into the city, but it's never a right-hand turn, because on a right-hand turn, you can keep your units together protecting their shield side. If you have to make the other turn, you have to expose yourself. Your lines and your flanks have to be widened. So I think I got that right. So yes, you got the left-handed slingers, of which the Benjamites were famous. Has anybody ever used a sling? An actual stone sling? I built one years ago when I first started reading the Bible. I was like 20, 22 years old, and me and my friend Jacob Bernath, we went over to his farm, and we built slings with baling twine and a piece of like a piece of cloth. It was about 5 feet, and we put not incredibly heavy stones in them, but you know, fairly heavy stones. And we just flung them, and it was, I mean, hundreds of yards. And they just went so fast. It would be terrifying, terrifying how effective a sling could be. I mean, David killed lions with slings. I mean, so they're monumentally effective weapons. They were the snipers of the ancient world. But yeah, I always thought that was kind of cool as well. So what else stands out to us about this text? Yeah, so I'm curious what people think about this. If Israel's in the right, if all the tribes who are attacking Benjamin are in the right, and it seems like they've made a fair effort, they come and they say, hand over the men who did this. And they said, no, we're not going to. And they hand them over or we're going to fight you. No. Okay, then we're going to fight you. Like, you need, these people did a wicked thing in Israel. But they don't win. They lose the battle. They lose, I think it's what, they lose two battles before they finally have success? And then how did they have success? The way they had success reminds us of who? There was somebody who fought a battle just like this, where they feigned an attack, they began a retreat, it looked like it was going to be a rout, and then people sneaked in, set the city on fire, and surrounded them. Joshua against whom? Well, it's one question twice. Wasn't Jericho. It was Ai. What happened at Ai? The Israelites lost. They lost. Because they went out to fight Ai, but that was when they caught Achan. Achan had sinned. He had stolen he took the wedge of silver, the tongue of gold, the Babylonian robe. He took all of those things and he hid them in his tent, all those things that were under the ban, the haram, and then Israel goes out and fights and loses. And then the second time they go out and fight, well, now they have victory. But again, this whole passage is full of connections to different parts of the Bible. The way the battle is fought brings us back to the second battle of Ai, where they resort to a ruse. What are the connections? Why is the, now again, I don't ask the question, why is the author? Because I think that the author is making these things up. What I'm saying is the author is selecting details from the story that are specifically chosen details. These things actually happened, but he's specifically giving us details of what actually happened to draw our attention to different parts of the Bible. Why is the author trying to draw our attention to what happened in Ai? Yeah. I like that. Yeah. Other thoughts. Why the connection with Ai? Now we can understand looking what future authors do, right? Like whether Samuel wrote Samuel and Judges, or if the same author wrote Judges and Samuel, that's up for debate. We don't know that. But obviously the author of 1 Samuel is deliberately choosing characters and behaviors and patterns of action from Judges, because he wants people who know the material of Judges to draw those connections and say, this is how I make my moral conclusions. I make my moral conclusions about Saul based upon the connections that Saul has to behavior in the Judges. I make my moral judgments about David based upon connections that David's behavior has to what happened in the period of the Judges. So is the author of Judges doing the same thing with Joshua? I don't know, maybe. Especially if the author of Joshua is of Judges is the same person who wrote Samuel, 1 Samuel. Because if the author of Judges is the same author who wrote 1 Samuel, then maybe what we need to do is we need to take the events in Judges and look back at the events in Joshua, and we're informed about Judges from what we see in Joshua. So what do we see in Joshua? We see the Battle of Ai, and I think that's a perfect example. I think your explanation is really good, Brian. In what happened in Joshua was the people disobeyed. They didn't listen. They should have listened to God, but they didn't. They did what they shouldn't have done. They broke a direct command from God, and then they lost the battle. But the question is, did the Judeans break any commands of God? Because it was Judah that went first. Did Judah break any commands? Yeah. I can't think of anything the rest of Israel did that caused them to lose this battle. So why do they? Why do they suffer? Why do the people who are only doing what is right, why do they suffer? Why don't just the Benjamites suffer? Why isn't it a complete rout where the only people who die are the handful of people from Benjamin who actually committed this atrocity? And those who explicitly defended them, not just the people who were forced at spear point to go and fight for the Benjamites, but the ringleaders and the people with actual power. How come they aren't the only ones that suffer? Why do seemingly innocent people suffer? You want to say something? Go ahead. I mean, it sounds like both of you guys have the same answer. I didn't know who to point to because you both had something. So I'm just like, I'll just look in this general direction and then whoever wants to talk. But I mean, yeah, right? Like, did the 36 men who died when Achan sinned, had they robbed? They didn't do anything wrong. They just went to bed. They did what they were commanded to do by Joshua. They did what God had commanded them to do. And yet they suffered. You know, I don't know for sure, and I forgive me if maybe this is, if I'm taking this in a direction that we weren't expecting, but these big stories here in Judges, it's summarizing so much material and saying, what happened at Gibeah is what happened at Ai. Innocent people suffered because of other people's sin. And like you said, the leaders, not just people in general, but people who were leaders. Innocent people suffer when other people do bad things. And the question is, who comes off smelling like a rose in this story? I mean, let's just begin with the obvious question that Brian asked. What's a concubine? I don't know. What do people think? What's a concubine? When you read that, when you read concubine in the Bible, if your Bible uses the word concubine, what is a concubine? Personal hooker? Live-in prostitute? Okay. Yeah, so, go ahead, Brian, you were going to say something else? The problem is everything you guys are saying is accurate. Because if we were to do a big survey of the Bible, this is the problem with the word concubine, is there's no single definition that seems to fit all the criteria. Because if you wanted the simplest explanation is it is somebody other than a wife to whom a man has exclusive sexual privileges. Now, sometimes that's a live-in girlfriend. Like there's no sense of property or ownership there. It doesn't seem like. Sometimes it is a slave. Sometimes it's almost like a second wife type of thing. But to Israel, there was a big distinction between being a second wife or a third wife or a fourth wife or whatever and being a concubine. There was concubinage is a weird thing as far as the history of the Bible goes, where people really aren't sure exactly what it meant, and we're not really sure exactly how to interpret it. It seems to me, and this is, I mean, if, you probably can find people who are very dogmatic on what a concubine is, but it seems to me the best way to interpret what a concubine is to take it on a case-by-case basis and say, okay, what's a concubine? How is a concubine meant in this specific instance, right? Because David and Solomon had concubines. Were they sex slaves, like in part of a harem? I don't think so. I think that a lot of them were political connections, kind of like how Solomon took a bunch of wives that were political connections. Maybe that was done with a harem of concubines in a similar way. It's really difficult to say. But what we can tell from this guy, this particular wonderful specimen of humanity, is she runs away. So, I mean, what's our first instinct to think about this guy? Yeah, what do we think about the Levite? Yeah, I mean, he's got his, whatever she is, if she's borderline slave, if she's almost a wife, whatever she is, she runs away. And he goes to get her. But then his father-in-law keeps him there for this extended period of time. And by the way, what does that remind us of? The father-in-law getting Moses and looking forward. No. Looking forward from this, looking forward to an event in the future. Oh, you know what? I didn't even think about that. But yeah, maybe. That's probably a fair connection that we should be drawing. Forward in history. Forward in history, especially in the Davidic kingdom. To me, it reminds me of David and Uriah. David has slept with Uriah, with Bathsheba. Uriah shows up. David does nothing but try to get him drunk and have him go have sex with his wife the entire time he's there. And Uriah is the only person in the whole story that acts honorably. And he's like, how can I go do that when the rest of Israel? But Uriah is a foreigner. How can I do that when the host of the Lord is sleeping in tents? Just twist that knife a little more there, buddy. You know, this story, and maybe it's a looser connection, but I don't think we're supposed to think very highly of the Levite. He's a bad husband, master, boyfriend. Whatever he is, he's not good. He has to go get his girlfriend from running away. Her dad, you know, doesn't want her to leave, so he, you know, proceeds to feast with him and get him drunk to keep him from going back. He goes back, and then what does he have the audacity to say? His servant is like, hey, we should probably camp at this town. And he's like, I'm not staying in a foreign town. I'll stay in an Israelite town. I'm not going to a foreign town. Okay. How'd that work out for you? And then what do we see? We see, I mean, just how incredibly cold and callous he is. I wanted to bring this up. I wondered if anybody noticed this. What is you guys' Bibles? I don't know what all Bibles people have, but what does your verse, chapter 19, verse 28 say? Hey, Eliza, Diane wants to study the Bible, not talk to you all night. You were supposed to go down with the kids' time. 1928. Yeah. You notice that the text is very silent on the status of her breathing at that point. Yeah. It is literally an imperative. It is and he said to her, Kumi vanachal. Kumi vanachal. Arise, we go. I think the NIV translates it well. The NIV translates that as it is, as an imperative, as a command. Not like, hey, you okay? the woman has been raped almost to death. Apparently, at some point, the men had left. You know, at daybreak, he doesn't go to check on her. It's, get up, let's go. I don't think we're supposed to think very highly of this guy. So yesterday, I was here at the church, and I was getting some work done, and sometimes I get work done. I was here at the church, I was getting some work done, and I had a meeting, I had a lunch meeting, and I got a phone call, and it was somebody who needed a ride to Van Wert. He was staying in the motel, and he's like, can you call somebody, or can you give me a ride? And I said, I kind of looked at my schedule, I'm like, I really don't have anything I need to do, and, you know, give to the one who asks from you. So I was real convicted by a John Piper sermon, so I'm like, you know what, I'll give this guy a ride. And so I'm giving this guy a ride, and, you know, believe it or not, the guy, you know, who's hitchhiking and staying at motels is not the normalest person you may have ever met. I called my wife, and I said, I've had an interesting day, and she says, yeah, and I said, believe it or not, the guy's kind of a weirdo. And my wife, she's like, really? That's shocking. But so this guy is clearly, I mean, living a weird life. And yet he told me, he started talking, pardon my language, I'm not trying to be crass or rude, I'm simply repeating what he said. But he said, yeah, I said, so is it dangerous, like, living the way you live your life? And he goes, oh yeah, he says, the faggots will try to get you all the time. I'm like, okay, interesting. But this was the amazing thing to me, and I promise you that this has a connection to the story. The guy's he's a weirdo. Doesn't have a job, never owned a house, his family will have no connection with him. He doesn't have a winter coat. He's panhandling and hitchhiking from town to town, but he looks down his nose at the faggots. Again, not trying to be crass. I'm simply looking from his point of view. This Levite is probably one of the bigger scumbags in the Bible. But he won't go to a foreign city. He's a Levite. He's a religious leader in the community. It's the arrogance in the story. It's almost comical arrogance. And I think we're supposed to see it. Because he says, I'm not going to go to a foreign city. Because I'm not going to go to Jebus. By the way, what city is Jebus? Does anybody know off the top of your head what Jebus? Jebus becomes Jerusalem. I'm not going to go to Jerusalem. I'll go to this other city. Interesting. But his choices go comically wrong. His callousness, his cruelty, and the way he chops her up. He could have sent a message. He could have said, hey guys, this is what happened. And then, by the way, look at verse 4 of chapter 20. I'm probably going to go a little bit long tonight, but look at chapter 4, verse 20. So the Levite, the husband of the murdered woman, said, because everybody shows up, and they're like, what's the deal? Why'd you cut up a prostitute and send her to us? You know, it's not Christmas yet. And so he said, I and my concubine came to Gibeah in Benjamin to spend the night. During the night, the men of Gibeah came after me and surrounded the house, intending to kill me. I don't think they were trying to kill you, bud. They raped my concubine, and she died. Did she? I took my concubine, cut her into pieces, and sent one piece to each region of Israel's inheritance because they committed this lewd and disgraceful act in Israel. Now, all of you Israelites, speak up and give your verdict. And the men reply. Again, his version of the story seems to diverge ever so slightly from the version that the narrator tells us. They took my concubine. I don't think they took her. She was inside when this whole thing started. So why don't you just tell the truth? Oh, well, because the truth would be inconvenient. Again, people making these decisions, these very shady moral decisions. And people could ask the question, they're saying, well, maybe they did intend to kill him. Maybe this guy's version of the story is accurate. We just don't have all the information. Maybe, but that's not normally how people tell stories. Normally, people give you the information they want you to have so you can make judgments based upon the information that you do have. This isn't a court of law. This is narrative. This is different. If this were a court of law, you'd have a co-counsel or an opposing counsel who would ask a redirect question and who could say, well, wait a minute, what do you mean they intended to kill you? How did you know they intended? You could ask these questions. We can't ask these questions. All we have is what the author gives us, and the author gives us details that the narrator's details differ from the Levite's details. We're supposed to notice that. The narrator in the Bible is always the good guy, by the way. The narrator's always the right one. Why is he lying? I'm asking this as a legitimate question to you guys. Why is he lying? What do you mean self-righteous? Go ahead. Please continue. Okay, so I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm asking, what did he do that he would have to preserve himself on account of what he did? Yeah. And I mean, truth be told, we all have a tendency. It's very hard to tell a story about ourselves that's perfectly objective. You know, it's really hard for us, you know, especially if there's an incident where maybe we bear some guilt. We all have a tendency. Maybe you guys don't. Maybe I'm the only one who does. We all have a tendency to at least be tempted to recount the event in a way that maybe, you know, has the sun shining on us a little brighter than it actually was, to paint our enemies in, you know, in black hats with twizzly mustaches. It's tempting. But again, it's wrong. He's a Levite. He's supposed to be an instructor of the law to Israel. He's supposed to not bear false witness against his neighbors. By the way, saying they intended to kill him is bearing false witness against his neighbors. Now, what they intended to do was horrific and gruesome, but they didn't intend to kill him. They intended something very different. They didn't intend to kill him. So he's now borne false witness. So this story continues. We've talked about it. Looking at chapter 21 really quickly, and I know that we've talked about this in the past, and I'm sorry that it's mostly me talking tonight. I promise when we start looking at smaller portions of Scripture, we're going to have more exchange. But looking at chapter 21, so a quick review, chapter 21, all the people, remember, had said, you know, they all swore an oath and said, we will not give our daughter to a Benjamite. But they're sad that all of Benjamin has been exterminated and there's like a few hundred guys left, and they find out, oh, you know what, there's actually this town that didn't show up, so let's go kill all the men and the women and only give, you know, marriageable age virgins to these Benjamites, and then we will do justice against this city that didn't come to fight, and the Benjamites can have wives. They do this, there still aren't enough, so they said, hey, when there's this party, go to the harvest festival and just kidnap a bunch of girls. And when their husbands or brother, when their brothers or their fathers come and complain, we'll say, hey, do us a kindness because we couldn't get wives for them after the war. And then you won't be guilty because you didn't give them to them. It's like, really, that's how that works, huh? And which, remember, by the way, what was this whole war about? Let's do this real quick. Let's look here. And so they instructed, verse 18 of chapter 21. Chapter 18, verse 21. Actually, going back, verse 16b. With the women of Benjamin destroyed, how shall we provide wives for the men who are left? The Benjamite survivors must have heirs, they said, so that a tribe of Israel will not be wiped out. We can't give them our daughters as wives, since we have taken this oath. Cursed be anyone who gives his wife to a Benjamite, or gives a wife to a Benjamite. But look, there's an annual festival of the Lord in Shiloh, that's where the temple is, or the tabernacle is, to the north of Bethel and east of the road that goes from Bethel to Shechem and to the south of Lebanon. That's, thank you for that, you know, specific instruction. So they instructed the Benjamites, saying, go and hide in the vineyards and watch. When the girls of Shiloh come out and join in the dancing, then rush from the vineyards, and each of you seize a wife from the girls of Shiloh and go to the land of Benjamin. When their fathers or brothers complain to us, we will say to them, do us a kindness by helping them, because we did not get wives for them during the war. And you are innocent, since you did not give your daughters to them. So that's what the Benjamites did. The whole war was fought because a Levite gave his concubine to the Benjamites, who raped her. They are telling the Benjamites to go commit hundreds of acts of kidnapping and rape, both of which are forbidden in the law. And then for the fathers to say, don't make a stink about it, and you won't technically be giving your daughters to them as wives, and we'll fulfill the need for Israel to have a tribe. The whole war was fought about this. This is what got you into the whole thing in the first place. So, what did we said before? the leaders do things and history just repeats itself. They didn't learn any lesson. They make this moral decision that breaking their oath would be so bad, but allowing a couple hundred acts of kidnapping and rape is better than a few hundred of them breaking their oath. Notice, did they inquire of Yahweh at any point during this? Not since after the war, as far as I can tell. Again, maybe they did. The narrator doesn't tell us that because the narrator thinks that we shouldn't know. I've gone over time, so forgive me for that. But I mean, what do we do with stories like this? That's a pretty good summary of it. I think, yeah. I think that's great. What you guys both have said is accurate. It's history's repeating itself, and people are not learning from the errors in the past. And when we look at the last words, I think verse 25 of chapter 21, this reminds us of what this whole story is all about. In case you missed the main point of the book of Judges, it's right here. In those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as he saw fit. The reason they have these moral conundrums is because Israel has no king. Now, does this mean that having a king is going to solve these problems? No. The writer of Samuel makes it very plain that having a king doesn't solve these problems. Their problem was Yahweh was not their king. They were not serving and obeying Yahweh, and everyone did what was right in their eyes. Not what was right in the eyes of Yahweh. They were doing what was right in their eyes. And all of their problems came from when they were doing what was right in their eyes and not what was right in Yahweh's eyes. And that's the lesson of the book of Judges. That's the lesson of most of the Bible as well. But the book of Judges stands out because we see that lesson so clearly. And when you fail, and I think that's the final point, and then I'll shut up. When we fail to ask God what's right in his eyes, we are doomed to repeat the same stupid, cruel, and horrific events of the past. You repeat history in a bad way when you refuse to ask God what's right in his eyes. Anybody have any final thoughts before we wrap up? All right, thanks everybody. I had a lot of fun. Oh, thank you for using all of Mrs. Hugg's paper. I'm sure that... Oh, goody gumdrops. Mommy will be so happy.